History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should never go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to invest a little time and attention, to ask some questions, and be patient enough to listen as long-buried memories rise to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we start out with those kind of intentions, it really is amazing what ends up happening, because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but as you know, we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This coming Tuesday, December 7th, will be the 80th anniversary of the infamous surprise attack on Pearl Harbor and other military installations that ultimately launched America into World War II. You might have guessed that that would be the focus of today's show, and your guess would be correct. There will be an 80th anniversary commemoration on Oahu, of course, this week, and unfortunately, the COVID era means the number of people allowed to be there is limited, but there will be quite a few World War II veterans on hand, including at least 9 who have shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes. Today, you're going to pick up some perspective from 7 different veterans who were on the island of Oahu that day. Separate vantage points that together help us understand just how chaotic that day of infamy was. You can link to complete full-length original interviews with each of the 7 online at hometownheroesradio.com. Some of these men are still with us, some are no longer here, but their stories live on. And the composite picture that they're going to help form over the next hour here on the radio will definitely help you understand. Let's begin with a man who had quite a unique perspective from an observation tower that is still standing 80 years later at Pearl Harbor. Here's what Delton Wally Walling saw from his unique perch just before 8 a.m. on December 7th, 1941.
It's a beautiful day, and all at once, overhead, we've got planes, high planes, low planes, all coming in on us. Oh, must be a big maneuver today. Those orange balls up there is not ringing the bell yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ringing the bell even when we see those black objects dropping out of those planes.
It hasn't hit you yet that this is enemy.
That isn't it. Mm-hmm. And when the bomb went off on Fort Allen and all planes are exploding everywhere, we know we're in war.
And you saw that clear as day.
I watch it all. I'm the only one that can tell you the Pearl Harbor story, and this is the reason why. I'm looking down on everything. You're on a ship, mm-hmm. and that ship gets hit by a torpedo or what? Who sees that? The ship itself. That's all. They can't see beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking down on everything. But remember this, you can't see it all at one time because everything's blowing up at one time.
Right.
So you can't even follow it.
Mm-hmm.
All you can just pick up in pieces. See?
Well, and that's what, you know, on this program over the years, I've heard from guys who are on a lot of different ships or on land while this is happening, and they have those little slivers of the puzzle that they saw from their perspective. And your perspective is intriguing, and what you're saying is you're the last guy left that was in that tower and looking from that spot where you could see each one of these things that's happening. You're, what, 19, 20 years old?
19.
What in the world was going through your head?
I'm froze to the rail because the first thing that happened just before the plane started dropping was Hickam Field is blowing up. It's right behind me. I'm looking, oh, maybe a couple minutes or something before the raid started right over Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So Hickam Field is destroyed immediately. Now I'm froze to that rail because I have joined the greatest Navy of all times. And here it is being blown up in my face in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm devastated. Because if they can do that in 10 minutes, what else is coming?
Right.
And scuttlebutt is everywhere. They've already landed on the other side, and oh man, you don't know what to believe.
I'm sure there's all kinds of stuff, and I want to hear about that, but I hope I didn't cut you off in describing what you saw there in the order you saw it. So you saw those explosions on Ford Island.
See, the Arizona never blew up till 8:06. It's the last ship that blew up. Because your California sunk, Oklahoma's rolled over, the Utah's rolled over, and the West Virginia's got hit by at least 7 torpedoes. It's a mess. It went straight down.
And you're seeing each one of these?
I'm seeing it after the fact. You cannot possibly see it because you're looking there, a bomb went off, one's already gone there. You're looking and seeing after the fact. We can't do anything. There's no way of us doing a thing.
With thousands and thousands of military personnel on Oahu that day, there are so many different vantage points. And we get another one from a Kansas native who had actually traveled to Oahu aboard the USS Arizona. Eugene Leonard's assignment was working on planes at Eva Field, a Marine Corps air base west of Pearl Harbor. Did you have any idea before December 7th? Was there any concern that the Japanese might attack?
None at all. Absolutely surprised.
Tell me about that Sunday morning. What's the first thing you remember?
I remember the airplanes flying about, 8-10 miles away. Coming in, they looked different, but they was tiny. You know, that's quite a ways away. And I could see torpedoes hanging halfway below the airplane. The nose would be pointed down from the airplane. That's what they used to sink the different ships.
So when you first saw the airplanes, did you think...
We discussed it. You know, all the guys, we stand colored, you know, your mom. Yeah. But, hey, what's going on? Hey, them, they look different. And as soon as that's over, of course, I had to go to my guard station. And when we went to the guard station, when we was attacked for this base, see, this is the first airplane come over our way, attacked the truck that I was in.
When you first saw those planes, did you think they were American planes?
Oh, no. I could see that red thing.
Even when they were far away, though? I mean, when you saw them on the horizon?
I didn't know what there was when they were far away. We didn't know what there was.
So did it start to trigger maybe something's wrong here?
No, I really didn't know something was wrong at all until we got in the ring and that plane come after us. Then I knew something was wrong. We knew right then. But it's already too late. We didn't have anything to do.
So you and another guard are driving a truck. How big a truck?
Just a pickup with a flatbed.
So you don't have much protection?
No protection whatsoever.
And the very first plane that comes in that's firing...
At that truck.
And that's where they came from, that direction. So they got to Eva Field before they got to Battleship Row, right?
No, they broke off from the battles. They was coming in from the north side of the island and across. And we could see them going across to Pearl Harbor. And you see, they just broke off. They had to get our airplanes too, you know.
Yeah.
And because they broke off. See, there was Schofield Barracks and Wheeler Armor Air, all them. They was attacking them all at the same time.
And you guys at your field had, what, about 40 or 50 airplanes?
Well, there was 3 squadrons, and we only had about 8 in our squadron. And then there's dive bombing, a fighter squadron, and another a scout bomber squadron.
And so some of those planes are planes that, had you guys been able to get them in the air, could have fought with the Japanese planes and inhibited the damage.
The rear gunners and all that would be after them, and the fighter planes and everything.
But they were able to destroy them all right there on the ground.
They destroyed them on the ground. No ammunition anywhere.
And they almost destroyed you. So your truck, the Japanese plane is firing machine gun bullets right at you. You got out of the truck. And
I got out of it, so did the other guy.
And you had an idea of where a safe place to go would be. Tell me what that was.
Well, that was the big building where the morning mask was, where the holes was in the ground.
So this Eva Field had been used in World War I with dirigibles, inflatable airships.
Right.
And so they had these big hangars, and there were holes ground. There
was no big hangars. There was no hangars whatsoever.
So what was the purpose of this building you were hiding in?
Well, it's just machinery to cables up and down for the tower.
But you knew that in that building, as kind of a leftover of the old technology, there were these big holes in the ground.
Right. There's just holes in the ground.
How big around were they?
Oh, it wasn't round. It was long, probably that wide.
4 or 5 feet?
4 feet, 5 feet long.
So you and the other guy run in there and jump in those holes?
He didn't follow me. No. I just went for the, I don't know where he went.
So you just knew that's a safe place to go?
I was trying to get away from the bullets is all I knew.
So you hopped down in this hole. Was there anything else in that hole?
No.
Nothing crawling on you?
Like I say, scorpions was all over the place, and was and spiders and all that. So that's about all that's around.
So you preferred a bug bite to a Japanese bullet?
I knew the holes were there. See, I was second in rank. The number one sergeant in rank was killed probably 75 feet from where I was at. He got out there for... grabbed a fire extinguisher where the airplanes was, and he got shot.
Were you guys pretty defenseless at that point?
We was defenseless.
You didn't have anti-aircraft guns or anything like that?
We didn't have anything, no ammunition or anything.
So the best thing you could have done is what you did, because there was nothing you were going to do to the Japanese. You just had to make sure you survived. What was it like to be in that hole? And what were you hearing? What was happening around you?
All I heard was the rattle of the building of the machine gun fire hitting it. I didn't know whatever. I just ducked down all I could in that to dodge everything. I happened to know that was there because it was right close to my work area, see. The airplanes that I worked on was right outside of that, right close to where I was at. But I just ducked down in the hole, see. Because I happened to know they was there.
How long you think you were in the hole?
5, 10 minutes. I don't know. I have no idea. I was ducked down and trying to, you know, work as much safety. And as soon as that building stopped rattling, I run to the guardhouse to get my rifle. And no ammunition, of course. And the truck took us. It'd come back to the guardhouse and took us to the ammunition sheds. And I got in there with a .45, broke the lock. And we loaded ammunition as fast as we could. They was in a cloth deal that full of 30-06 ammunition. And we was just that ammunition to people. Everyone was grabbing rifles and everything else. And, of course, then... got machine gun ammunition and all that. But, hey, the machine guns, the stands all broke up. We armed ourselves just as fast as we could, if ever we could, because we figured they was coming in for a landing, which they did not do.
Yeah, so you guys really weren't prepared for that initial attack, and then after that you prepared and nothing else happened.
We prepared for an attack by land troops, because that's the only thing we could do.
And the reason I asked you how long you were in the hole, and you said 5 or 10 minutes, something tells me it felt like a lot longer than that.
I don't know, because it's not very long. It doesn't take very long to set the airplanes on fire. They're just sitting on the ground everywhere, lined up. Mm-hmm. And, hey, they could come down... hitting them airplanes and fire, they got them on fire so fast you can't believe it, because it all lined up.
What was going through your mind as you were in that hole?
I don't have any idea. It was just that I was trying to save myself. I didn't know what was going on except that I was being shot at.
When the building stopped rattling and you came out of there, what did you see? What was the scene around you?
Airplanes on fire, just piles of planes are burning. All that fuel had to be burnt. See, it's burning everywhere.
So many things were burning on Oahu 80 years ago, but out of those flames emerged a united American resolve that would help defeat the forces of tyranny in World War II. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, another military installation on Oahu that day, Hickam Field. Hear from one man on the ground there on that day of infamy, as well as one who happened to be trying to land there just as the attack was underway. Before we're done, we'll hear firsthand perspectives from Battleship Row as well. This special Pearl Harbor 80th anniversary edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our special Pearl Harbor 80th anniversary edition of this program. This coming Tuesday is that anniversary, which means Wednesday will be 80 years since President Franklin D. Roosevelt uttered those unforgettable words. We are listening to memories from men who had unforgettable experiences that day. And one unique perspective that has always stuck with me came from Robert Thacker, who was piloting a B-17 bomber that had taken off from Northern California the night before, to finally arrive in paradise that Sunday morning.
We had been up all night for two nights, no sleep. You're young and you think you can have anything and do anything. So we really weren't concerned. And all of a sudden, here's this big hole in the clouds. I look straight down, Diamond Head. My navigator had flew 2,500 miles and wasn't off 1 mile by shooting three star fixes all night long. Hobdy, great guy, great navigator. So I let down through the hole, flying along. My radio operator had been there before, and he said, there's Doris Duke's home. We're blah, 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 blah. And I saw these scratches in the sky, and I said, what are those? And he said, that's volcanic action. And there's the Royal Hawaiian, and I said, blah 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 on the horn. No answer from the tower. No answer from me. This is 8 o'clock in the morning, and you knew when the attack started. When 8 o'clock. So I said, hell, I can see. I said, where is Hickam? He said, you see that big white tower there? That's Hickam, and that's the Pearl Harbor. So I said, what's that great big column of black smoke that just went up? He said, they're burning off the cane fields. Well, that was the Arizona going up. And I said, what do you know? Blah, blah, blah. No, I said, come up here and give me a new frequency. I can't get anybody. So, I can see the runway. I can see that big black smoke and see which way the wind is blowing. I'll land this thing because we're out of fuel. We're exhausted. We've been up all night, two nights in a row. So I cracked about half flaps and dropped the gear and started over Ford Island. All of a sudden, a tower came on and said, number Air Force 432, you're number two to land, land north to south. We're under attack by Japanese aircraft. And exactly like that, bang, 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 all over the place. The Navy was shooting at me. Well, I was right over Ford Island, and everything was on fire, and anything that was airborne that morning, you know, was what? It was the Jap. And I've been criticized by calling the Jap, but in those days you used the word Jap. Now it's Japanese, which is fine with me. But I said, my God, I'm going to get out of here. So I dropped the throttles, broke out of traffic to the right, landed crosswind. There were three zeros jumped me, and he shot the right gear out. I ground looped on the end of the runway and took a look around. And I said, I think we better just redirect here. All I needed was a tire and bombs and fuel, and I could go. And I started towards the flight line. And I said, no, I think this is a mistake. Let's go between Hickam and the commercial air drop. In those days, it was nothing but a big swamp. So we went over to the swamps, and that's the best idea I ever had, because right then, these 13 in a nice V-level Japanese bombers came over Hickam, and they just wiped out the flight line, killed a couple of friends of mine on the flight line, and if we'd have been over there, we wouldn't be here talking to you.
That was Robert Thacker, and while he was attempting to land at Hickam Field, Ed Hall was already on the ground there.
And then I heard the darndest explosion you'd ever want to hear in your life. Now I thought something blew up outside. I ran to the back door, looked up Hangar Avenue. Hangar 7 and 9 had blown up and debris was flying everywhere. And I thought, my God, an airplane exploded in one of the hangars? And then about that time, Hangar 2 and 4 was right across the street from me. The entrance was in line with the door where I was standing. Guys were running out of the hangar, scattering all over everywhere. And then I saw puffs of asphalt kicking up. What the hey? And then I saw this plane coming across the runway the wrong way. Holy mackerel, who's this idiot? And then I realized that's gunfire. And this plane is coming right at me. And this guy is so low, he couldn't have been more than 25, 30 feet off the ground. But he had to pull up to miss the building and the electrical wires that were outside. That's what saved my life, because he was coming straight at me. As he flew over, I looked up. He was looking down at me, and I was looking up at him, and he had a big smile on his face. I mean, that's how close he was. And I could see him. So then I went running out hollering for Alex, where is everybody? Well, they had all disappeared. Oh, I got to tell you one other. As I turned around, before I could yell at Alex, I decided I got to hide someplace. Where, oh, the kitchen sink. So I dived under the kitchen sink. And things seemed to quiet down just for a second or so, and that's when I got out. Started yelling for Alex, and I ran outside, and now I'm still in awe. I'm staring out in the air, looking at all these planes flying around. And one guy reaches out from under the eave of a building, grabs me by the shoulder, curses me out, you're going to get killed, get under here. And I didn't more than get under the eave of that building. Here comes another plane strafing, took off about 2 inches of that edge of that building, number two.
Second time your life was saved.
Second time. So now this is the heck with the mess hall. I got to get down to the motor pool because I know they're going to need drivers. So I go down there, and I was told to take a truck and go up Hangar Avenue and do whatever I could to help out. Well, It always, even to this day, it seems a mystery to me how this happened. But as I got up near the hangars, it had exploded, which was right across the street was the big barracks. And the guy come running out, waving his hands, "Stop, stop, I need you, I need you." I said, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm a medic, we got wounded. We got to get them to the hospital." So that's what I did for the rest of the day. And then we took a load over to the hospital, came back over on Hangar Avenue, and went in between the hangars, picking up wounded. I picked up one dead lieutenant, and he had a 45 automatic. I figured, well, his guts were spilled all over it. He don't need it. So I took his 45 and never cleaned that belt either. It still had blood on it the day I had to turn it in when I came back to the States. But I believe it was the second, or could have been the third trip that we made. We got strafed again. The tires were shot out on the truck. And we had bullets come between him and myself through the cab that just missed both of us. Actually, we didn't realize that until we stopped and picked up another wounded. Well, we stopped when the tires went flat. Not to pick up a wounded, really, but there was wounded there. And as he got out and went to shut the door, he says, "My God, Ed, look at the holes in the roof." And I looked at him, "My Lord, where the..." And then I realized the tires had been shot out, and these handgun bullets came through the roof of the cab, number three. Well, that was my three close calls for the day. So the rest of the next 2 or 3 hours, we were still roaming around looking for wounded. I couldn't tell you how many people we picked up that were wounded.
Are we talking like dozens?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, at least. And I believe I have... I just knew these fellows. I can't say they were friends, but they were acquaintances. Leonard Beasley, Eugene Denson, and Robert Kelly. Now, Robert Kelly I knew real well. They were killed that day, those three. All three of them belonged to the 42nd Bomb Squadron.
Ed Hall, remembering three of the 189 airmen killed at Hickam Field on December 7, 1941. Members of every branch of service were involved on that day of infamy. Francisco Paredes was in the Army, assigned to Schofield Barracks.
I was on my way to church for Mass, and all of a sudden I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off, and they says, "This is not a drill, this is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations." I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. He was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead. And then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down, because he started going towards the ocean. So that's when everything went haywire. So I start picking up fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. I start pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads, and it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that.
More than 2,400 Americans were killed on Oahu on December 7th, 1941. And of course, nowhere were the losses more catastrophic than on Battleship Row, where the USS Arizona and the USS Oklahoma accounted for more than two-thirds of all the lives lost that day. Hear from a survivor from each of those ships when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we prepare to mark the 80th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor this coming Tuesday, December 7th, 2021. Within just a few short years, there will be no one left to experience that fateful day firsthand. Another reminder of the importance of capturing those stories when we have the chance. I'm so grateful to have met Don Stratton, whose family is there this week on Oahu for the anniversary. Don is no longer with us, but his account of what he endured aboard the battleship USS Arizona that morning on a day when 1,177 of his shipmates lost their lives is something I'll never forget, and I don't think you will either.
My battle station was a sight setter in the port and aircraft guns on the port side, and that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on the tripod mast on the foremast.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before. But when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot to do with the good Lord, I guess, and but we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that threw us a heaving line with that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and a small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burnt like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
How did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number two turret went into 1,000,000 pounds of ammunition, and it blew up. It just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we're kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. Six of us went across there.
But I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
You're just trying to get out away from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here.
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heave line, which is a small line, and then tied on the heavier line, and it was about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60-plus percent of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burnt. I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt, and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who were on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on, probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach, and they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most certainly figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit in a lot of casualties, but it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of patience.
Yeah, where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive? Or did that take a while?
No, they got a notice that I didn't make it, and then they got a notice that I did. But they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of baths, a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm and kept us burns open to the healing air. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went to boot camp again because it hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff, and I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406 USS Stack. We headed for the South Pacific right away, and we were in on the invasion to Hull Land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there. And we went to Guadalcanal and picked up troops to put in the Philippines and the Lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the minesweeps, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pick of a patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost 5 ships one night there, and they sent me back to the States, and the war was over, and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that, and that you've told your story many times. So that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess. Felt like maybe I should be there, but whatever happened. But that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes were still out there.
Still on your ship?
Yeah.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live. It's just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so I was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and I went back in. Like I tell everybody, everybody had to be someplace, and I was there.
If you've never read Don Stratton's book, it might make a great gift this holiday season. After the 1177 lost on the Arizona that day, no other ship suffered more losses than the USS Oklahoma. 429 gave their lives at Pearl Harbor. That battleship's crew included Richard Swede Artley, who had been excited about serving on the same ship as his brother, Darrell.
We had just come back from breakfast. We thought we had something that run into us when the first torpedo hit. But the Navy says they're absolutely positive that 8 torpedoes hit the Oklahoma and very likely 10. I was in the steering room aft. I was just below the waterline. There were 8 of us in there. We had lights for about 10 minutes. Then the lights all went out. Of course, the ship turned over to port 151 degrees. Just a little bit of her bottom sticking out of the water.
And we've seen those famous pictures of the Oklahoma on December 7th. I have to ask, I haven't talked to anybody who was through what you were through on that day, to be trapped like you were. As those torpedoes are hitting, what did that feel like? What did that sound like? And did you have any idea where you were or what was going on?
Well, I knew where we were, but I didn't know that we had gotten into a war. We just tried to keep from getting hit by things flying through the air when the ship was turning over to port. And I didn't do a very good job because we had a guy named Woody Havens, who was a heavyweight wrestler. He was a second-class quartermaster. He had all kinds of equipment down there, dumbbells and all that stuff, you know, to train on. And one of his dumbbells, I don't know why, I could never make myself understand what the heck I was doing in the telephone booth. But I had just stepped out, and one of his dumbbells came down and hit me in the leg.
Did it break your leg?
No, it didn't break it, but I had 13 bones in there that sprung loose.
So this is all happening on December 7th, 1941, as a nation is about to realize that it's at war, and you were realizing it before pretty much anyone else. I mean, the very first torpedoes were hitting your ship, would sink your ship, and you're trapped inside your ship as it's turning over. When did you realize that you were trapped and what was going on inside that room? What kinds of things were being said? Set that scene for us if you can.
I didn't know we couldn't open any of the doors in the steering aft, but they were all locked from the other side. If I'd have known that, I would have gone nuts. And so we just, I slept some of the time down there, and the water was still coming in. There was a fresh air blower coming into our room because it was hot down there. Oh, God, it was hot.
So these air vents are letting water in. You can't get out. So the room is filling more and more with water, less and less with air, and you guys are running out of time.
I think so. I talked to Jim Bounds one time, and I asked him, just a short time before he died, I said, Jim, how much time do you think we had left down there before the compartment was completely full of water? He said, I think maybe 15 or 20 minutes would have done it.
And how long were you down there?
Well, we got out about 6 p.m. Monday night.
And this happened before 8 a.m. Sunday morning.
The ship had already been hit with all those torpedoes and already turned over. And they drilled holes wherever they had to get to us. We were very fortunate. We had 2 seamen on there. They'd gone to quartermaster school in the States before. They had just joined the ship about 2 weeks before the war started. And they knew Morse code. Somehow they got to talking to some of these people. And they finally told him, don't talk to us anymore. We know where you are, and we're coming as fast as we can. When they did get down to us, they drilled these holes. They said, get ready to come out. When you get ready to take you out of here, just stiffen out. Because they had both sides of the places where they'd had those holes drilled. They just passed us out of the ship. And there's a Liberty boat down there, and one of the guys, George DeLong, he said, I was sure hoping I could go to Mass tonight. And this guy says, man, this is not Sunday night, this is Monday night.
You guys didn't even know how long you'd been down there.
I didn't have a clue.
You were trapped inside a sunken ship, running out of air to breathe, water filling up this hold. You were trapped in there for 34 hours.
That's right.
But you're talking about it like it's no big deal.
Well, it was a big deal, all right, because I knew if we didn't get out of there, we're done. Oh, I was scared. We all talked very positively. They'd get to us some way. Lieutenant Commander Hobby was the ship's first lieutenant. He kept talking to us, and we got down where we could talk to him verbally. We got our spirits up, and we thought, now he's going to really get us out of here. By golly, they did.
When did you find out for sure that your brother was one of the casualties that day?
No one ever did come and tell me. I just had to accept that as I know Daryl didn't get through it.
Have you ever stopped and wondered what Daryl would have done with his life if it hadn't ended on December 7th, 1941?
Daryl was one hell of a baseball player, good pitcher. He was on the Oklahoma team, and I'm sure he would have gone into pitching in the big leagues sooner or later.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who didn't lose siblings in the war, but lost friends. And a lot of them felt like the life they led, that they couldn't take anything for granted. They had to stay positive and move forward, because if their friends had lived, that's what they would have done. Did you ever feel anything along those lines, feeling like you had to live in a way that would have honored your brother's sacrifice?
I tried to. Probably didn't do a very good job. I used to think about him all the time.
That was Richard Artley from the USS Oklahoma. And that idea of remembrance, that's what the legacy of Pearl Harbor is all about. Every one of the seven men whose memories you heard today, and the dozens of other Pearl Harbor survivors who have shared their stories here over the years, they've all emphasized that motto of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association: remember Pearl Harbor, keep America alert. As more and more of those survivors leave us, that mission increasingly falls to the rest of us. So maybe that's something to devote a little thought to this week. What can we do to make sure the sacrifice of those lost that day and the lessons of Pearl Harbor are never forgotten? Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.